We have on Sunday nights been studying through at least part of our Bible reading for the week. This week we actually covered a part of the Bible reading this morning as well in Psalm 110. Now, when it comes to the Bible reading, I'll be honest with you. As you read through there are some weeks I look at the Bible reading and I think, how in the world am I going to decide what I'm going to preach on from the Bible reading? There's just so much that's there that we can learn from Genesis or Exodus. And then there are other weeks when I read through the Bible reading and it's a little bit more of a struggle to think about what is it that God intends for us to learn from this. I've avoided the book of Hebrews, for example, in our reading since we're studying that on Wednesday night. And the book of Leviticus is a book that is a real challenge sometimes for us to look at and try to learn something from. We talked a little bit about the first seven chapters last week. But as we continue our study tonight in Leviticus, I want us to understand just the basic outline of this chapter again, or of this book. We have sacrifices and offerings in chapters 1 to 7, the priesthood in chapters 8 through 10, laws about cleanliness in chapter 11 through chapter 15, laws about purity and holiness in 17 to 22, feast and ordinances in 23 to 25, and then warnings regarding obedience and disobedience in chapters 26 and chapter 27. And if you can at least get that outline somewhat in your mind, it helps you to be able to locate things within the book of Leviticus that you are looking for. Particularly, by the way, remember the first seven chapters about sacrifices, the part about priests, and then chapter 23 is the part that is going to describe the feast. So if you have a question, you know, even in the New Testament about Passover or Pentecost or some other feast, that's the location you want to go, at least one place you want to go to get an answer to those questions. What is the purpose of the book of Leviticus? The book of Leviticus was written to show Israel how to be a holy nation in fellowship with God. It was a manual from which they were to live and conduct their lives. By the way, the importance, I think, of the book of Leviticus is seen in the fact that when you were a Jewish youth, the very first book that you would have been taught would have been the book of Leviticus. You might think as you read through that, why in the world would that be the beginning point for Jewish youth? And the reason is because this is the book that tells them about how they were to conduct themselves and live as that holy nation. And so it is that manual of law and worship for Israel. And it really is a contrast of the holiness of God with the sinfulness of man, and particularly the holiness that God expected of His people, Israel. The book of Leviticus, if you really want to remember what the book is about, I would define the theme as really being that of being holy as God is holy. In a couple of key verses, sorry, that's a little bit off the chart. Leviticus chapter 11, 44 and verse 45, that was read for us a moment ago. You shall be holy, for I am holy. We'll talk about that concept in more detail in a moment. And then again, in chapter 19 and verse 2, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. If God's people want to have a relationship with God, they're going to have to be holy people because God was a holy God. Now, when we think about the name of the book, just a couple of things I want to mention in introduction before we get into some lessons that we learn. The book of Leviticus derives its name from the Septuagint. In the Septuagint translation, the name was given, I don't know exactly how they would have said that, Leviticon, but it really means pertaining to the Levites. And perhaps to some degree, that can be misleading. And that is that we think of this book as a book that pertained only to the Levites. And the reality is, by the way, if I do a quick search through the book of Leviticus, the word Levite only occurs twice, and it's in back-to-back verses in chapter 25. It's really not a book that was exclusive to the Levites. It certainly gave them instructions about their roles, about their responsibilities, but it was really intended for all people. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, it is simply called what is the equivalent of, and he called. Oftentimes, the Hebrew books of the Bible were identified by the first word that occurs in that book. For example, the book of Genesis is the book that states in the beginning. And the book of Leviticus in the Hebrew Bible is just simply, however you say that Hebrew term, and he called. It is God's calling to his people. Now, when we think about lessons that we learn from Leviticus, I think that it's oftentimes we look at this book and we read through it. And as one commentator said, there is what he referred to as mundane information within the book. I mean, you read about in sections about plowing your field and the kind of seeds that could be sown and laws about cleanliness and uncleanliness or clean and unclean food that does not apply to you and I today. And so how is it that we apply passages that don't apply to us, if you understand? In other words, what is it that God intends for us to learn? Well, let me just simply say that as I look through the book of Leviticus, I think if there's one lesson that you learn from this book, and the application that's even made as it's quoted in the New Testament, is that God expects his people to be a holy people. One of the key words that is found throughout this book is the word holy. In fact, the word holy occurs in the King James, the New King James Version of the Bible some 95 times in the 27 chapters of the book of Leviticus. The word, by the way, in contrast of uncleanliness or sin, the word uncleanness occurs 116 times, and the word sin occurs 102 times. And when we think about this idea of holiness, the idea of holiness is that of apartness or sacredness or to be consecrated, to be set apart. For example, when we think about it, to be holy is really the opposite of being unclean and defiled. It's the idea of being clean and being pure. Do you have your Bibles, Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 10, that the Lord said that you may distinguish between the holy and the unholy, between the unclean and the clean. So if we think about, want to understand this idea of holiness, that it being holy is the idea of being clean as separate from unclean, pure as in contrast to impure. And it really carries it, the idea of being separate. Leviticus, and that should be chapter 20. Leviticus chapter 20, and in verse 26, I want you to notice here in the book of Leviticus how he defines this idea of holy when he said, "And you shall be holy to me," talking about Israel. "For I am the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from others that you should be mine." The idea is that they were separated from all the other people of this world to be God's people. They were set apart. And the idea behind the book of Leviticus is really reminding these people that since he was a holy God, he demands that his people be holy as well. Do you remember there in Leviticus chapter 11, again in 44 and 45, the reason they needed to be holy is because God himself is holy. We sometimes sing a song that's based on Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 3 or Revelation chapter 4 and verse 8. But in the passage in Isaiah chapter 6 and in verse 3, Isaiah the 6th chapter and in verse 3, we read there concerning the seraphim praising the Lord. And as they praise the Lord in Isaiah chapter 6 and in verse 3, what they are saying is holy, holy, holy. Do you see that verse 3? Is the Lord of hosts. The earth is full of his glory. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 8 says exactly the same thing. The idea, and we sing the song, holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. The idea behind that, according to Barnes, by the way, in his commentary, I don't have the quote on the chart, or according to Bible Knowledge Commentary, is that the threefold repetition of the word holy suggests supreme or complete holiness. In other words, it's not just that he's saying three times God is holy. It's not simply repetition. It was a repetition for emphasis to say God is as holy as it comes. He possesses supreme holiness or complete holiness. In fact, when we think about God's holiness and God's glory, it fills the earth. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 21. He said, "But truly as I live, all the earth is filled with the glory of God." In fact, if I had to define the idea of holiness from a Bible verse, I would say the idea of God being holy is very similar to the idea of God being light. And in Him there's no darkness at all. 1 John chapter 1 and verse 7 says, God is light, and in Him there's no darkness at all. That's why in the very next verse, it's saying you want to have a relationship with God. You want to have fellowship with God. You know what that's going to demand? It's going to demand that you walk in the light as well. Because God is holy and He's separate from sinners. He always does the right thing. And what God is demanding of His people is God is demanding that His people be holy as well. In fact, we must respect God's holiness. We need to come to accept that. And we accept God's holiness when we do His will. I want you to turn in your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 10 in verses 1 through verse 3. Leviticus chapter 10, in verses 1 to verse 3, is probably one of the stories of Leviticus. There's really only two stories, narratives in Leviticus, one in Leviticus 10, the other in Leviticus chapter 24. But this is probably the one we're familiar with. The story of Nadab and Abihu and how they offer strange fire to God, and God comes out, or the fire comes out from the altar, and it destroys them. Now, if we were in a Bible class, and I was to ask this question, why is it that Nadab and Abihu were destroyed? Why did God cause fire to come out and devour them? We'd probably get a variety of answers, and all of them perhaps are correct in some way. Somebody might say, well, they acted without authority for what they did. Well, that would be a correct answer. They certainly didn't did that which was unauthorized. The Bible specifies that. Somebody else might say, well, I tell you, the reason they were destroyed is they didn't worship God in the right way. And that could be a correct answer as well. But I want you to notice what God said in response back. And what God said when He destroyed them is, by those who come near Me, I must be regarded as holy. In other words, the problem with the unauthorized worship, the problem with the strange fire, is it was a sign and a symptom of the fact they just did not respect God. They didn't regard His holiness. And God said, I must be revered. I must be respected as holy. And what I learned from that is that when I respect God's holiness, then I want to do what God tells me to do. I want to follow His instruction, whatever that instruction is. As I've said before, oftentimes I connect in my mind two verses together in terms of application. Here's the two I want you to connect. Leviticus 10 verses 1 to verse 3, I must be regarded as holy. With 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 says, but sanctify in your hearts Christ as Lord. Here's the command that applies to us as Christians. The English Standard Version says, in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy. In other words, you need to honor Christ as being holy. What does it mean to honor Christ as being holy? To honor Christ as being holy means to do what God or what Christ tells us to do. Relate that back to Leviticus 10, when God says, when you disobey Me, you're not regarding My holiness. You're not regarding my separateness, that I am indeed the God of all of the earth. Well, not only must I respect God's holiness, I must be holy myself. In fact, Peter quotes from the book of Leviticus to make this point about Christians. Remember in the book of 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 15, where Peter really sets off the theme for the book by quoting from the book of Leviticus. And the book of Leviticus, he said, be holy as I am holy. Do you ever wonder, as you read through the book of Leviticus, now I wonder why God gave all these laws to the people? Let me just illustrate some of that. Some of this that doesn't apply to you and I today. But for example, let's go to Leviticus chapter 11. And we read through all of these things about what you can eat and what you can't eat. Clean and unclean food. I mean, just for example, if you lived under the old law, you couldn't have had pork this morning for break. Couldn't have had you some bacon or sausage. You couldn't have a barbecue with pork. That was forbidden under the old law. You couldn't have a good piece of catfish under the old law. I mean, all of this is detailed in here. Some of it, by the way, I wonder as I read through it, did God really need to tell the people not to eat that? I mean, some of it, as I read through there, I think, who would want to eat some of that that is mentioned in Leviticus chapter 11? In other words, you and I may look at that and say, why in the world did God do that? Look at verse 45. After giving all of this, he said, I am the Lord who brings you out of the land of Egypt. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. In other words, you're going to be different. All of these things were a reminder, a daily reminder to the people that they weren't like everybody else. They were different. They were God's people. And many of these laws were not because things were inherently wrong in and of themselves. It was simply a way of God reminding the people that they were a different kind of people. Same thing is true, by the way, over in Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19, you read such things as, you shall not sow your field with mixed seed. You and I may go out in the field today and we say, we're going to plant half of it in corn, we're going to plant the other half in beans. There's nothing wrong with that. But God said under the old law, what? You can't do that. If you could look probably in your clothes, probably most of us have clothes that's a mixture of some kind of fabrics. And yet God said in Leviticus chapter 19, you shall not wear a garment of mixed linen, and wool shall come upon you. And you know what occurs over and over through chapter 19? He tells them to do something, and he ends it by saying, for I am the Lord. In other words, this is a reminder of their relationship to God and how they're separate and distinct and different from all other people. In fact, could you see the value in that? As opposed maybe to just simply regulations about their worship and about their what they did in terms of sacrifices, they needed to be reminded every single day of their relationship to God and of their separateness. And we have to be reminded, by the way, that we're God's special people today. That, a lot of those regulations don't apply to us. But I want to tell you, we have to be reminded every day. And let me just also mention this, by the way, in passing about the book of Leviticus and the book of Deuteronomy as well. You have to keep in mind, when you see some of these laws that are given, that the law of Moses was both a religious law, but it was also the civil law under which they lived. And so there were regulations that applied to that. I think there are regulations, by the way, that were intended to keep the people healthy, to keep disease from spreading through the people of Israel. Some of the laws about cleanliness and uncleanliness there is some roots in now, at least in what they would warn for on a just simply a base of hygiene. In other words, how to avoid becoming sick. Some of those, in fact, some of the book of Leviticus, when you read through that, shows the scientific foreknowledge that God had in some of the laws that he gave the people. But there needed to be this daily reminder that they were a different kind of people. And what we need to be reminded of is we're God's people today. And we're a holy people. And what that means is that we're going to be different than the world's going to be. Our conduct is not going to be the same. In fact, when you read through the book of Leviticus and the book of Exodus, you hear statements, or you read about statements like, you're mine, you belong to me. And I want you to remember that. And you read passages like Exodus chapter 19 and 5 to 6 about them being a royal priesthood and a holy nation. But here's what I want you to remember. You get over to the book of 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, and God uses exactly the same language to talk to you and me today. We're a chosen generation, a royal people, His own special people, or a people for God's own possession. You know what God is saying to us as Christians? You are mine. Act like it. Live holy and godly lives. And I tell you, I also want us to learn, as you go through the book of Leviticus, what I think is a very important principle, and that is holiness is largely about daily righteousness. A large part of the book of Leviticus, yes, we concentrate on, sometimes when I read through it and you start concentrating on, look at all these sacrifices. And now, if I had a skin part, that place come up on my skin, would I have had to go to the priest or not? And if it turned white, and if the hair in it was yellow, and it just sort of makes our head spin. But I want you to realize this. If that's all you see in the book of Leviticus, you really miss something. Because the book of Leviticus is largely about daily righteousness. It wasn't just about the sacrifices they offered. It was about how they conducted themselves day in and day out. Come to the chapter 19 and you find principles like this. Respect your parents. Don't worship idols. When you sow the field, you should not wholly reap the corners of your field so that there's gleanings for the poor to come. By the way, remember Leviticus chapter 19 when you get over to the book of Ruth and you see Ruth come to Boaz's field and you see her reaping? I think what Boaz was doing was exactly what the law of God had commanded him to do in Leviticus chapter 19. But it's about kindness. Be honest in your dealings with others about verse 11. Don't steal. Don't deal falsely. Don't use a false weight, he says in the latter part of the chapter. Don't profane God's name day in and day. Tell you what, we talk about worshiping and honoring God when we come together. That's important, just like it was with Nahab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 20. But I tell you what's also important is I treat God with reverence and respect in how I talk about Him day in and day out. By the way, if you read through it, I can't remember where we ended. I've already gone through the book of Leviticus. But the only other narrative story in the book of Leviticus that's not law is in Leviticus chapter 24. And it's about a conflict between two men. And one of them profanes God's name in the midst of the conflict. And Moses has to go to God and say, okay, what are we going to do? And God said, take him out and kill him. You know why? Because God demands respect, not just when we worship Him, not just in the sacrifices that we offer, but in our daily conversation. Don't be partial. Don't be a talebearer. A lot of that has to do with daily righteousness. And I tell you, I think sometimes we've got to be reminded, just like the people of Israel, that being a Christian is about more than what we do when we come together. Let me tell you, I believe with every fiber of my being that what we do collectively is important. And that when we worship God, we've got to worship God in the right way. We've got to go through the right acts. But I want to tell you, that's a small part of being a Christian. That's a small part of what God calls on us to do. Being a Christian, being holy, is about what I am day in and day out. It's about what I am. For example, when you get to the book of 1 Peter, which is sort of a counterpart in some ways to Leviticus, because the theme is the same, be holy as I am holy. He's saying it's about what you are in government or in the relationship to God. It's about what you are in work. Are you a good worker? Do you submit to your master? Are you a good husband? Are you a good wife? How do you treat your brethren? Are you tenderhearted? Do you care about them? Do you pray for them? I mean, on through the book of 1 Peter, he's emphasizing being a Christian, being holy is not simply about what we do collectively. It's about how we live day in and day out as children of God. And the question for you and the question for me is, am I really living like the holy people of God? Does the world, you know, one of the things about the people of about the book of Leviticus, it was to mark a distinct difference between here are my people and here are the people that live in a completely different way. Sometimes I wonder, when we look at our lives, does the world really see that we're different? Is that how you're conducted? Do you see that you're different in how you live and how you dress and the things that you do? Holiness is about daily righteousness. I tell you, if you don't learn anything from the book of Leviticus except this one point, learn that God expects His people to be holy. And that's about what we are every day. But I'll tell you something else I want to notice real quick, and that's about the sacredness of worship. And I'm not going to develop this point fully, but one has to be impressed with the details in the book of Leviticus in matters of worship and service. I am. I say sometimes it almost makes my head spin to start thinking about, I sure am glad I wasn't a priest under the old law. Should I heave that or do I wave it? Do I, you know, exactly, is this mine or do they take part of it? I mean, you look at all the details, it can be mind-boggling. Now, it's you can figure it out, but it's certainly mind-boggling. And the thing I learned about that is God expected him to do it exactly like he said. And no better points that out than Nadab and Abihu. Their crime, pulpit commentary says, was not in doing what was forbidden, but in doing what was not enjoined. Will worship is offensive to God, and no body of uninspired men has any business to decree rites and ceremonies. I think they can say that exactly right. In other words, what they're saying is this. Their sin was not in doing what was forbidden. It's not that God had to come over here and say, okay, listen, don't get that fire from right here. Don't get it right here. When God said to get it from before the altar, if that's indeed the sin, then you know what that did? It eliminated everything else. There's your passage on the silence of the Scriptures. And yet, when they did what God told had not authorized, had not enjoined upon them, guess what happened? The fire came out from before the Lord and it devoured them. You mean God expected them to do it exactly like God prescribed? Absolutely. Sometimes today in talking to our religious friends, somebody will say, now do you really think it's that big a deal that we do things exactly like God prescribed? John 4 and verse 24 said, God's a spirit. They that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Can I give you a word of advice? Sometimes I think we make a mistake in teaching our religious friends. And the mistake we make, first of all, is we want to get right to the argument. And I mean by that, that we've got this person wants to be baptized, and before I lay any foundation in groundwork, I want to get right to argue with them about the necessity of baptism. Or I've got a religious friend over here, and they believe it's okay to use instruments of music in worship. And before I lay any foundation, any groundwork, what I want to do is I want to start arguing with them about instrumental music. And I tell you what we do when we do it that way, sometimes we're largely ineffective. You know why? Because we're not arguing from the same basis. We don't have a common foundation. Sometimes the best way to approach a religious friend, if you can get them to study with you, is by going back sometimes to these principles of the Old Testament. In other words, go back and talk about Cain and Abel. Talk about Nadab and Abihu and get them to understand the principle. Before you ever start talking about instrumental music and worship, before you start trying to argue about whether it's authorized or unauthorized, go to these passages. Even raise questions. Do you know what Nadab and Abihu said that did that was wrong? Well, I'd be surprised. Most religious friends might respond, well, they didn't do what was authorized. So would it have been wrong for them to do something besides what God said? If you can get them to commit to that principle and understand that principle, then you can move on and talk about how instrumental music and worship is unauthorized. But sometimes our difficulty is we want to go straight to trying to argue about a subject without the laying of the foundation upon which to build that on. These stories found in the Old Testament provide wonderful opportunities to teach principles that still apply today, even though the law that we live under today might be different. But John 4 and verse 24, God's a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. You probably heard me say before, I sat one time in the feet of a preacher preaching a lesson on John 4, and he said, we've got to worship God in spirit and in truth, and the most important part of that is spirit. Well, no, I deny that. I would also deny it, by the way, if he'd have said the most important part of that is truth. What John is saying, what Jesus is saying, is it takes both of those. It takes the right acts with the right attitude to make acceptable worship. You take either one of those away, and guess what? You don't have worship that's acceptable to God. But I learned something about the sacredness of worship. I learned something in this book about respect for discipline. I'm just talking about some isolated stories here in Leviticus. The story of Nadab and Abihu is the most familiar story. And God comes out and He fire devours them. That's some severe discipline, by the way, on Nadab and Abihu. And what I want you to think about for just a moment is I want you to put yourself in Aaron's shoes. You think Aaron loved his kids just like you love your children? You think Aaron was proud of Nadab and Abihu? Just like you're proud of your children, I'm proud of my children. And I think the answer to that's not, there's no doubt at all in this world that he loved them. And he cared for them. I want you to notice two things in this story as it relates to the discipline that's infected upon them. First of all, I want you to notice a phrase that's easy to miss. And that is, in Leviticus chapter 10, after it relates what happened to Nadab and Abihu, and God said, and I must be regarded as holy, and the Bible just simply says this, and Aaron held his peace. You know what that tells me? Aaron knew what God did was just. What God did was right. And Aaron just held his peace. He didn't complain. He didn't start arguing with God. He didn't say, well, now that's just not fair. But instead, he just held his peace. Now, was Aaron sad? You better believe he was sad over that. In fact, if you read through the rest of Leviticus 10, and this is why you need to read through those stories in their fullness, you get a little bit later in Leviticus chapter 10, and Moses comes in and he says, now, this goat that's supposed to be eaten, why didn't you eat it? And Moses is livid, by the way, at that point in time, that it hasn't been consumed as God had commanded. And Aaron said, listen, I'm paraphrasing, I'm so distraught over what happened, there's no way I could have eaten that in the proper frame of mind. Because, and the point Aaron is making is, I'm saddened over what's happened. I'm distraught over the loss of my children, what has happened to them. It may have been fair, but it affected him deeply to the point he said, I couldn't have eaten of this in the proper frame of mind, and it satisfied Moses, and he just sort of let the matter go. But I tell you something else I learned here. You go back in Leviticus chapter 10. Leviticus chapter 10, and you go through the rest of this, God gives some very clear instructions to them. Not only does the Bible say Aaron held his peace, it goes on to say God tells him, don't uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the people, but let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. You shall not go out of the door of the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die, for the anointing of the oil is, of the Lord is upon you. And they did according to the word of Moses. I wonder, you think how hard that'd be? By the way, to Aaron and to Eleazar and Ithamar, this is basically what he's saying. He's saying to them, listen, you've got a job to do. And your job is to be, you let these other people mourn, but I'm going to be number one. I'm going to be above family, and you're going to go in, and you're going to worship me, and you're going to fulfill your duties. Don't go mourning, and don't go basically crying and not doing what I told you to do. You do your job as priest. And they did that. I want to tell you something. We need in the body of Christ today is we need more parents like Aaron today when it pertains to church discipline. And that is sometimes that they realize that discipline has to be administered. Now, it's not severe discipline like what God did with Nadab and Abihu. But sometimes the disorderly have to be withdrawn from. Sometimes children that are unfaithful need to be disciplined for the sake of their soul, to bring them back to the Lord. And I tell you what we need is we need parents like Aaron who understand the purpose of that discipline, who are willing to hold their peace. And by that I mean they don't complain, they don't holler about how unfair it is, but they understand that God has the interest of all of His people at heart, as well as the interest of that child. Somebody told me a story one time of a preacher's child that had become unfaithful to the Lord. And the church of which they were a member called them and said, y'all haven't been faithful in attendance. You haven't been being what you need to be. And if you don't change, you don't repent by a certain time, then we're going to be forced to withdraw from you. We're going to be forced to exercise church discipline. And the first thing she did when they got that letter in the mail or the phone call, I can't remember which it was, she got on the phone to her daddy and she said, Daddy, you ain't going to believe what they're doing. What are we going to do? And he said, honey, this is what I'd do. The first thing I would do is I'd get on my knees and I'd thank God I'm part of a congregation that cares enough about my soul to do what they can to try to rescue. See, that's the kind of answers that need to be given, isn't it? Not those that offer defense, but those that realize that it's for the good of them. That Aaron, for all that we may say about Aaron's mistakes sometimes in the Scriptures, I tell you, Aaron shines to me in Leviticus 10 for how he responded in the midst of that discipline. Very quickly, the condemnation of immorality and sexual deviation. Some of the things that happen in the book of Leviticus. First of all, I learned that sexual deviation and immorality aren't new. You know, sometimes we look at our day and time and we start sort of thinking about, oh, look at all the problems we've got today. I mean, we've got homosexuality being flaunted and homosexual marriage and marriage, in fact, don't mean anything to anybody. Look at what we have to deal with. I want to tell you one thing I learned. You go back, this is taking place about 1,400 years, I'm giving an approximation, before Christ ever came. 1445 to 1450 B.C. would be the approximate date of the Exodus. And so we're over 1,400 years away. And you know what God says as He deals with the sexual deviation, before He talks about homosexuality and immorality, He said in chapter 18, you're not going to act like the Egyptians act. You're My people. You're not going to act like the Canaanites act when you get into their land because you're My people. And what that verse is imply is these things were common among the heathen nations, even at that day and time. Sexual deviation and sexual immorality are not new. They've been around a long time. And yet God expects His people to be different. There is, and I'll just mention a couple of things here, there is the condemnation of homosexuality and bestiality. And those, and by the way, the Lord's not dealing with male cult prostitutes in Leviticus chapter 18, Leviticus chapter 20. There's not a word said about that. What He said is a man shall not lie with a man as with a woman. It is what? An abomination. And the same thing about man and with a beast or a woman with a beast. In fact, you read through that, and what God said is if you do that, the land's going to vomit you out. What I learned in that verse is the land is pictured as literally getting sick to its stomach over the kind of sexual immorality if it came into the land. And that's why God said, this is not to be named among you. And God's attitude hadn't changed. In fact, I can't think of a single point of morality that really changed between the old law and the new law. And what I mean by that is that we don't live under that law, but you think about points of morality. I'm talking about things like stealing, adultery, murder. God's attitude about those now are exactly the same as they were back under the old law. I learned something. I find this section to me extremely interesting. The section about nakedness in Leviticus chapter 18. You remember how God goes through that whole section and He says, now you shall not uncover your daughter-in-law. That's your son's nakedness. You shall not uncover this person because that's so-and-so's nakedness. In other words, it doesn't belong to you. And I think there's no doubt that there's an application, and probably the primary application is to fornication and adultery. But I want to tell you, there's a broad principle here that I noticed, and that is your nakedness rightfully belongs to only one person, and that's your spouse. Your nakedness doesn't belong to anybody else. It's theirs. And I think really what God is saying, yes, in a context condemning fornication and adultery, is to say your nakedness shouldn't be shown to just anybody. And while there's application to be made, brethren, to fornication and adultery, there's also some application to be made in the area of modesty. I wrote an article several years ago. One of these days I might see if I can locate it and reprint it. But I wrote it in a local church that I was working with, and the title of the article was, I've Seen Too Much of You Lately. And I'll be honest, sometimes their brethren I've seen too much of. In the sense that their nakedness is uncovered. Even as they come to church. When in passages that talk about, for example, the thigh being uncovered being nakedness. And the same in Exodus chapter 28. Listen, whether you're a young man or a young lady or an old man or an old lady, there is one person that ought to see your nakedness, and that's your spouse, and it doesn't belong to anybody else to see. And unfortunately, we live in a society in which we see nakedness everywhere that we turn, and people just sort of smile at it with impunity. It has its effect. I saw some figures the other day, by the way, on pornography. It was statistics about the problem among religious people. And the figures are just absolutely astounding. I'm talking about when you take religious people across the spectrum, when you have upwards of 80% of people saying they look at that, I'm talking about religious people on a regular basis. What that tells me is we've lost sight of the fact that there's a whole lot of problems wrong with that. But have you ever thought about the fact that if you view that person you're seeing, their nakedness doesn't belong to you. That's not yours to see. You know who it belongs to? It belongs to their spouse and to their spouse alone. And so we need to cover our nakedness. And when we do that, when we're guilty of adultery and fornication, we're taking something, 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 5, that belongs to somebody else. And very quickly as we close, I appreciate your kind attention, we reap what we sow. Leviticus chapter 26 and 27. Now, I know you haven't gotten there yet, unless you're ahead. I realize that. But I want to go ahead and finish Leviticus up in our study here tonight, and I hope you're probably glad to finish Leviticus up as well. When it comes to 26 and 27, here's what God says. There's a certainty that you reap what you sow. This is a very similar part of the book of Deuteronomy. When God tells the people, obey and you will be blessed. You serve me and you're going to dwell in the land, and you just read through that, the land that flows milk and honey, and I will take care of you and you will be my people and you will be blessed. But you disobey me. You turn your back on me. You don't want to keep my commandments. You're going to have to suffer the consequences of that. And it's a principle that is found throughout the Bible. And the principle is, the very broad principle is, we're going to reap in accordance with what we sow. Sometimes people have the idea that they can get by with disobeying God. By the way, sometime read through Leviticus 26 and 27 and also Deuteronomy, where Moses stands and they read the blessings and the cursings, and then go through back to the book of Kings and Chronicles and read through what happened to the people as they disobeyed God. And what you see is it's almost verbatim what God said. This is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And they turn their back, and guess what happened? Exactly what God said. Exactly what God said. And we need not think today that we're going to be able to disobey God and not reap in accordance with what we sow. But I want to tell you, there's something else I learned in the book of Leviticus. By the way, Hebrews chapter 2 said, if God punished people under the old law that disobeyed, what do you think He's going to do to people under the new law? But there's something else. There's the offer of forgiveness. You know, one thing I think we sometimes say that's inaccurate is to say that the old law was not a system of grace or mercy. Now, I realize there's a difference in the old and the new law. And I realize we have forgiveness under the old law and they didn't under the old law. But let me just say, God extended mercy under the old law. How could a God that is willing to forgive, who is long-suffering, be anything but merciful? I mean, I challenge you to read through the books of the Kings and Chronicles and the Mighty Prophets and come back and tell me God's not patient and God wasn't merciful to those people. And what God said in Leviticus chapter 26 is even after all that disobedience, if you come back, if you turn back, if you'll make things right and ask me to receive you back, I will receive you. I will take you back. God offered forgiveness, but there was a time when that patience of God ultimately ran out. The book of Leviticus, I would be dishonest, again, if I did not say it's a challenging book for me. I don't know that I've ever studied through the book of Leviticus in a Bible class section by section, as we do some of the other books of the Bible. But that book was preserved for us. And there are things we can learn as we go through that book and be reminded of. And again, if there's one thing I want you to learn through the book of Leviticus, in addition to the fact we're not under that law, and I'm grateful for that, is the fact God expects His people to be holy. Whatever God demands of us to be holy, that's what God expects us to be. We are different. We are God's people. And we ought to feel special as a result of that, but that also means we ought to feel a tremendous sense of responsibility as the people of God to be holy, even as God Himself is holy. Soldiers of Christ, arise. We're going to sing that song. Maybe that there's somebody here that needs to obey the gospel. If you can do that tonight, being buried in the waters of baptism, you become a child of God, you become a member of the Lord's army. Then continue to fight, and you can have that home in heaven someday. Or maybe there's somebody that's obeyed but has wandered away from the Lord and needs to come back. No matter what your need is, take advantage of the opportunity. Please respond right now as we stand and we sing.